Let's play word association. When I say computer scientist, Stanford PhD, Google researcher, and black woman, who do you picture in your head? Is she a model minority? That smiling face on the diversity brochure?
So I just thought, this is a field that I like, and I was very preoccupied with not being seen as like the black woman doing black womany things.
Dr. Timneet Gebru was all of those identities. And then, after getting a cryptic calendar invite from her boss's boss, she became unemployed.
One of the most prominent black women working in artificial intelligence today.
A well-respected Google researcher said she was fired.
Contentious departure from Google.
So did you resign or were you fired?
I did not resign. I believe I was fired.
From WBEZ Chicago, this is Art of Power. I'm Aarti Shahani. Today, how Dr. Timneet Gebru became a different kind of tech unicorn, a woman and an underrepresented minority in the industry. We discuss the wild turn of events from warfare back home to Stanford University that led her to one of the most powerful firms on earth, Google, and then how exactly she left in one of the most high-profile departures the tech world has ever seen. What did this backlash teach you about how power works?
That we're in a system where the powerful get away with it. I mean, they get away with it.
Dr. Timneet Gebru was born into conflict.
Tank and artillery shelling started at dawn and raged throughout the day.
Her family lived in Ethiopia, but they were of Eritrean descent. The two sides were mired in a brutal war. She was under threat of deportation in Ethiopia and forced conscription in Eritrea.
Forced conscription. So we were able to flee before we were deported, but a lot of other members of my family were deported.
I see. After a brief stint in Ireland and a long stint with the U.S. asylum system, Timneet's family got to Massachusetts. She was 16. She recalls being a migrant from Africa and feeling for the first time what it was like to be black in a largely white country.
The racism in the U.S. was a huge shock. It was unlike something I've ever experienced before, and I didn't expect such deep-seated racism in Ethiopia. It was clear, hey, you're Eritrean. Eritreans are like this, like that, like that. In the States, they won't say that straight to your face.
What's an example of that?
Oh my God, I remember this specifically. Every time I did well in a test, my honors physics teacher, he would come to me and he would say, oh, you must have studied so hard. And then he would go to this Chinese American student right behind me and be like, that's a genius. That guy's a genius. Like he
just must have been innately talented.
Yeah, innate. And but my mom from the very beginning would try to tell me, I'm like, why would my physics teacher say this? And she would say, because you're black, they don't think black people can do these things. And they think that, you know, Africa's just primitive and this and that. And then I would argue with her. Can you believe it? I would say, what is your evidence for that? Like, you know, he's nice.
But you would basically be telling your mom, hey, you're jumping to a conclusion.
Yeah, you're jumping to a conclusion because he sounds like he's thinking about for my benefit, right? I think it was in the autobiography of Malcolm X where he talks about how one of his teachers where they would tell him that he shouldn't think about being a lawyer, but he should be more of a carpenter because, you know, that's better for him and things. And they really would talk to him as if they're really thinking about his future and concerned for his future. And that's what I experienced too. And it was just so confusing. Whereas when people are straightforward, you know what you're dealing with. So it's not as confusing, you know. My guidance counselor told me that I wouldn't get into any colleges at all, even my safety schools. And I started believing it. So I started thinking, how do Black people exist in the U.S.? And especially if you're born and raised in that condition.
Yeah, that reminds me of Michelle Obama's counselor dissuading her, saying she should not apply to Princeton because she's not Princeton quality.
Exactly.
Despite the prediction from her guidance counselor, Timneat did get into college. A great one. Stanford. She earned a bachelor's and then a master's in electrical engineering, then a PhD. With a passion for math and physics, she entered the workforce as an audio engineer at Apple.
I was not at any point thinking, how does this audio circuitry or whatever affect the world in any way? I was just like, oh, I'm interested in this tinkering and this thing, figuring out the bug. And it was a very comforting world because if I'm thinking about other things like war, you know, there's all this bad thing happening in the world, but at least when I'm doing my engineering stuff, I don't have to think about that. So that was just my attitude.
And so, Timneat, I mean, what you're presenting to me, it's a very interesting character sketch.
Yeah.
It's complex. You're a complex person. It's not like you're this outspoken advocate of ethics in artificial intelligence and you were just born that way. You went through a period of, I mean, it sounds like trying to prove that you're smart, trying to prove that you can roll with the guys, with the white guys, white and Asian guys. Like, it sounds like you went through that period.
Yeah.
But then something does gradually flip in you. Talk about that. I want to understand your awakening.
In graduate school at Stanford, it was even more shocking than undergrad. There were literally no Black people, like none. You have this school that talks about diversity and that, you know, is at the cradle of Silicon Valley, et cetera, that has never graduated a Black woman with a computer science PhD. So that was stark. And at the same time, I saw that my collaborators in the school would like completely gaslight me. Like they would like argue with me that there is no such thing as racial profiling and over-policing of Black communities does not exist, blah, 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 like stuff like that, right?
And did you have personal experience to the contrary?
I absolutely did. I absolutely did.
Which was what?
The worst one, I think, was a time when my friend and I were attacked and I called the police and it was a whole ordeal.
Timneat recalls this one night when she was at a bar with her friends and they were assaulted. Timneat says she called the police and when officers arrived, they handcuffed one of her friends, a Black woman, and put her in a cell for the whole night. Did you tell your fellow classmates and or colleagues about it?
Let me tell you something. One of the people I told, who might not remember, who is a very, very, very high up person right now in a very well-known company doing a very consequential AI, told me, oh, she must have been acting crazy. I was like, what? I just like, is this how you would respond if someone told you, right, that you're, you know, if your sister told you this happened to her? No, right? So I was seething, but this is how the most influential people today in artificial intelligence, this is how they would react.
And you know, I have to ask this, Timneat, are you able to name the person you're referencing who's high up in tech?
No. I'm not really going to do that right now. Don't you think I have gotten in enough trouble right now? Like, don't you think I have?
I mean, you've burned so many bridges. What's another?
I might do it at some point.
Timneat says she'd seen a lot of people behaving badly. But still, she could not get herself to believe that the technology they were creating was bad.
That came when I saw Joy Boulamini's TED Talk.
Hello, I'm Joy, a poet of code on a mission to stop an unseen force that's rising.
Joy Bulomwini is a computer scientist. She's also Black, and in her 2016 TED Talk, she explained how facial recognition software that's being used all around the world and touted as objective is not able to correctly identify the faces of Black people.
You might have seen this on Facebook. My friends and I laugh all the time when we see other people mislabeled in our photos. But misidentifying a suspected criminal is no laughing matter.
She talks about how police departments were adopting this faulty technology,
using algorithms that have not been audited for accuracy.
She makes the case that biased algorithms are leading to new tech-enabled discrimination.
I was like, oh my God. Now I'm thinking, wow, okay, like drones, who's considered a terrorist? Who's going to be considered a problem?
Timnit reached out to Bulomwini. They became fast friends, and Timnit became Bulomwini's advisor for her master's paper. The paper looked at three leading facial recognition technologies. They found the tech was really good at identifying the gender of light-skinned men, over 99% accurate. But for darker-skinned women, the tech got it wrong up to 34% of the time. It occurred to them that this paper was good enough to publish. Did you expect it to make waves?
I didn't. Joy did.
It did make waves.
A study by researchers at MIT shows that the gender of darker-skinned women was incorrectly identified 35% of the time.
That's likely because the data used to train the software is often overwhelmingly white and male.
And do you think that this could exacerbate the already egregious inequalities in our criminal justice system?
It already is.
Why do you think it managed to make a big sound?
I think that it brought together a lot of threads that people had been thinking about in a way that allows you to fight back. Let me give an example. Trine Morin, who is one of the Brooklyn tenants, was fighting against face surveillance against their landlord installing cameras, right? But then found this paper and said, hey, look, I can now take it to the lawmakers and show them that this is a problem, that it's not even accurate. People have been fighting surveillance for a long time. But now what you show very, very clearly is the disparity of it.
This thing that's supposed to be unbiased is incredibly biased. And finally, you have rigorous research to prove it.
Yeah. So sometimes I feel like, you know, that's what research does, right? That's what these numbers and these experiments and do. It's a common language for people to understand the extent of the problem.
Mm-hmm. What did that teach you?
First of all, it taught me a lot about the many different groups of people who have been fighting this battle for a long time without being heard. And so it plugged me into that community. It taught me a lot about how to utilize my research experience to advance specific movements and goals. And it also taught me about how companies react to these things.
One of the very notable reactions following your research, as well as a growing social movement, was that three companies, IBM, Microsoft, and Amazon, announced that, at least for a temporary period of time, they announced that they would stop selling facial recognition software to law enforcement.
Mm-hmm. That was a long, hard road, right? Because before Amazon announced that, do you know what they did?
What did Amazon do? Embrace with curiosity and self-awareness this research that was deemed rigorous enough to publish in a journal specifically for artificial intelligence experts?
Bezos' position is presumably going to be, no, we're going to keep doing what we're going to do. Please go away.
Amazon leaders decided to keep selling their software to police, despite the finding that it was faulty, despite the protests of Amazon employees.
Employees are asking the company, Jeff Bezos, to not share the facial recognition technology with law enforcement.
Bulamwini and another woman, Deborah Raji, took the time to do more research and publish yet another paper showing how Amazon's facial recognition tool exhibited gender and racial bias.
How did they react to this paper? They tried to attack Deb and Joy's work. They tried to attack the technical and they tried to discredit it.
The general manager of Amazon's program for artificial intelligence, he said the tests run by these women produced, quote, false and misleading conclusions. Tim Need and others jumped in with another rebuttal. It became this tedious stalemate. Until the entire political landscape around the fight changed.
After the worldwide Black Lives Matter protests, you know, finally they're like, okay, we're going to have a moratorium, right?
Amazon says it is temporarily banning police and law enforcement from using its controversial facial recognition software.
So what did that teach you? This you do this rigorous academic research and then one of the giants discredits you. And then effectively caves in a way without ever saying sorry.
Right. So that experience was a really good experience to showing how tech companies, large tech companies, are really not going to do anything on their own unless they are forced.
Why did that show that these guys aren't capable of self-regulation?
Because VP after VP came down hard on this scientific peer-reviewed paper by these two Black women, and they did everything trying to discredit their work, right? And for them to even have a quote-unquote moratorium, it took a lot on that one specific, very well-studied problem, of which there are many more, right? And so it's not like they saw the results and said, oh, hey, yes, you're right, you know? And so that's what it taught me.
They put up a real fight.
Yeah, and it taught me how big of a fight it's going to be moving forward. They're going to throw all of their resources into preserving the status quo.
After the break, Dr. Timneet Gebru gets recruited by one of the most sought-after companies on Earth. And
3 months into it, I am sobbing, I am crying.
This is Art of Power. I'm Aarti Shahani. Hey, listeners, we are starting a new feature this season. Ask Aarti Anything. Are you trying to change your career? Figuring out what major to pick in college? Unsure how to fund a bold project? Write to us at artofpower@wbez.org about the specific problem you were navigating. I, along with my incredible guests, will help you and potentially feature you in an upcoming episode. Again, that's artofpower@wbez.org. Google.
Uh-huh. What about it? Google, yeah.
In 2018, Dr. Timneet Gebru took a job at Google, specifically as an ethics researcher, to help the company see where its artificial intelligence systems might be doing evil. The field is called ethical AI. Timneet was torn about going. She says she didn't dive in wholeheartedly because she'd heard about a culture of harassment at Google that gave her pause.
I went with the caution, but it was still worse than I expected.
And what are the red flags, briefly?
Oh, so many. I mean, they were attributing my work to this other guy. Like, so much stuff. Like, I also asked if I, for instance, could be named as a co-founder of the center that they were building in Accra.
In Ghana.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And because, you know, I've been putting a lot of work into it, they said, no, you know, titles don't really matter. And I'm like, well, why don't you give all the women the titles then and all the men not the titles if they don't really matter? I see. Okay. I was just, oh my God, so incensed, you know. And what else? Oh, they hired me at a level 4, whereas I found out that another man with way less experience was hired at a 2 levels higher than me.
Uh-huh. You did go, right?
I did, yeah.
And the decision to go suggests to me that even with the cautions there, you were hopeful. I can get things done in this huge tanker.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
How do you feel about being there?
Not good. I pretended that I was not there. That's how I was handling it. When I was there, I would just like, you know, see all these men that I knew something about. Like maybe they harassed people before Google. Maybe they were harassing people at Google. And they would just like walk by and have a great time and laugh and make jokes. And I just, you know, it was so difficult for me to see that over and over again.
And so how did you focus your time?
I tried to focus my time on my research. That's, you know, again, like always, this is always my mode. Is when I was a refugee, I tried to focus on my schoolwork, which is what I would have control over. So here I was like, look, I'm going to do my research the way I always do my research.
But Timnit was not able to just focus on her research. On May 25th, 2020, her efforts to compartmentalize her work life and her real life crumbled.
These are the last moments of George Floyd's life, unarmed, handcuffed, and pinned to the ground.
State charging documents allege that Chauvin had his knee on Floyd's neck for more than 8 minutes.
A white Minneapolis police officer, Derek Chauvin, murdered a black civilian, George Floyd. On the streets in dozens of cities, protests erupted.
Demonstrators have started to come up and down this thoroughfare.
You can see police here now firing tear gas into the...
Back at the Google campus, a place where employees ride multicolored bikes to cafeterias serving free organic food and kombucha, a place typically immune to social unrest, Timnit would not let her colleagues ignore George Floyd's murder. Her AI team, which had about 4,000 people in it, was scheduled to have its quarterly all-hands meeting. Timnit was slated to speak. She was on an email thread with others planning the agenda.
And in that email thread, I said, I can't do this. Like, I can't just go and have a normal research all-hands and take my 10 minutes or whatever to talk about whatever research when this is happening. So my suggestion is you just give the floor to Black researchers. Give us the floor, give us the research all-hands, and we will decide how to use the time. And so that's what I requested.
To whom?
To Jeff Dean and...
the boss of your division.
Yeah. And like, there were like, you know, some PR people there too. And they were like, you know, trying to like gauge what we're going to talk about, or is it going to be incendiary or whatever. And I was just like, look, just one time, just come on, leave us alone, you know? And so that's what happened.
So they gave you the floor.
Yeah. I think there were thousands of people. I heard it was one of the second most watched research all hands in history at Google.
Before the meeting, to prep for it, Timnit and her colleagues surveyed Black employees in the research division to ask what issues and concerns they might have with the workplace. They named several.
Number one was that there was no psychological safety. You speak up, you get retaliated against. So the first thing we asked for was psychological safety. Another thing we asked for was like a racial equity assessment, impact assessment by an external body. You know, there was like a number of things.
And so you did this survey and then at the all hands meeting that was viewed by thousands of people.
A number of Black people spoke and talked about what they'd like to change, what they'd like to see changing. And so it was a very honest, like, you know, we believe that you will listen to us and hopefully do something in this moment.
You wanted to echo the issue happening outside and show here's how it's happening inside.
Correct. And that was a huge frustration of the people at Google, because you had like this email after email, we stand with our Black, you know, whatever, this and that. And they are talking about things as if this doesn't happen at Google. Mm. And we said, you know, change starts from home. Look in the mirror. Mm.
So you do this. I mean, what is intellectually and emotionally a pretty heavy lift.
Yeah.
What was your boss's response? Were they happy with you?
Well, you know, everybody wrote like, oh, it was one of the best presentations. So many people wrote that, including Jeff Dean, including all these other people. Hmm. Now the question is, okay, well, we gave you this gift. Like, we did the work. We compiled all this stuff. We gave you precisely exactly what to do. Just do it then, you know, just do what we just asked you to do. That's not what happened. We had one meeting, I remember, where I asked, you know, okay, what are you doing based on this presentation? And they would say, oh, we're going to have this mentorship program. And I'm like, did you hear anybody saying they need a mentorship program? Did mm-hmm. Was that one of the principles? Was that, no, right? But
I mean, as I hear it, you kind of stepped in at a moment where so many people were looking for meaning, catharsis, a place to channel their energy. And you gave it to them. And so to some extent, the emotional work you did for the largely white and male division, it was actually quite helpful to them to channel the frustrations that people might be having.
Yeah. And I think that was what we were afraid of. We were afraid that they would have a great show and a short, nice presentation, and they would feel good about just the fact that they allowed us to do this, as if, you know, that's, you know, we
that's
should be grateful
work.
For that.
Right.
And then that's it. And I think that's what happened. I mean, worse happened, of course. Yeah.
The worse she mentions between giggles, it's the reason Dr. Timnit Gebru is one of the most high-profile departures in the history of tech. It all revolves around, of course, a research paper. I want to attempt to summarize what the paper was about in the interest of saving time.
Sure.
You can tell me if I got it or if I botched it, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Timnit co-wrote a paper that criticizes the ethics of large language models. Bear with me. Imagine buildings full of supercomputers that vacuum in every single word on the internet in order to slice and dice human language and create products like apps that translate between English and French and Mandarin, or bots that mimic humans. I read the paper. It points out some ethical issues with this cutting-edge supercomputing. For one, it contributes to climate change. Also, it can be very biased, and it can be weaponized to spread propaganda, misinformation. Like, I really feel like we're in class and like you're my professor and I'm just trying
you're
to-
You're
like,
doing great.
I'm trying to show you I did the reading.
Okay. You did the research.
Though I should point out, this field could also make Google billions upon billions of dollars. So you raise these concerns in your ethics paper.
Mm-hmm. As is my job to do so. My responsibility. What I got hired for, what I got paid for, apparently.
And the reaction?
So first, we submitted it to the internal, you know, processes, etc. Everything seemed to be fine. And then at this meeting about quote-unquote responsible AI, where all these VPs were, and I made the mistake of telling people, oh, hey, yeah, our team wrote a paper about these large language models and ethical considerations. Like, I just was like, you know, they're like, oh, somebody was like, oh, send us the draft. I'm like, sure.
So you send them the paper, and then what
happened? I didn't send them the paper. I just said the paper exists. So one day, I see a calendar invite. Just let's say right now, like for 2 hours later, like 4:30 p.m.
Oh,
Okay.
I don't know what this meeting is about. It's from Megan Cacciola, my manager's manager. Super weird. Why is my manager's manager putting a random meeting with no notice, no information at all on my calendar? So me and my colleague, Vinod, attend, and my manager, Sammy's there. And his manager says, you have to retract this paper. I'm so sorry. A bunch of the product people think, you know, it should be retracted. I'm like, what problems do they say?
Huh, the product people, people who make things that Google sells, they think you should retract.
Yeah. I don't think she understood how research papers worked and what it means to ask a researcher to retract their paper. I don't think she understood what she was asking me to do. And she just thought I should just do it now, not ask any questions, not. And I was like, well, this is not okay, because they had months to be able to talk to me about this. And they're doing this last minute with no information, no notice, nothing. So I started crying, actually. I was extremely upset. Oh, my God. Like, because at this point, I am exhausted by Google. You know, retaliation. This one guy tried to threaten to sue us for defamation because me and my friend were talking about how our friend said he harassed them. We gave examples. And then Google lawyers were trying to throw us under the bus. And then there was this other incident and another incident. And I was so exhausted. And I said, you know what, maybe I can just focus on my work. And then now they're like coming for my work, you know. And
it's so, like the safe space that you'd built, like the little box that you thought, at least here I can live in peace.
Yeah, I can at least do my work. But the thing is, if you're asking me to retract these kinds of papers using your power, rather than some academic peer review process that tries to shield people from this effect of the power dynamic.
It's the antithesis of that process.
Precisely. And if I agree to that, then my paper, whatever papers I write, end up being propaganda for Google only. And that's a huge integrity problem as a researcher. I can't do that.
And so they're putting you in a position where if you do what she's telling you to do, you could be grossly compromising your integrity and your future.
Yeah, exactly. And it, to me, it was really not about this paper. I didn't find this paper to be super special. Sure, whatever, I'll take my name off and it will be published without my name. That's fine, you know? But now I'm like, what is the premise under which I'm going to be doing research here? And also, what about my team? And how are they going to do their jobs? And what process are they going to be using to figure out what research they can and cannot do?
Had you cried in front of your bosses before?
Oh my God, let me tell you something. I was at Microsoft for 1 year. Nobody had ever seen me cry. Like, no one. I was at Google 3 months into it. I am sobbing. I'm like, they thought I was, that was normal for me, but it's not. I don't remember the last time I cried in front of people.
Tamneet pleaded for an explanation. What exactly are the issues with this paper? The publication deadline was still months away. There was time to fix it. But she says she could not get answers. She had to wrangle. And finally, on Thanksgiving Day, her manager read her a one-page synopsis of the issues, she says. Tamneet wrote a point-by-point rebuttal. She thought this was an open dialogue. She sent it off. And?
Nothing. They don't respond to that at all. They just kept on being like, hey, have you retracted the paper? Have you retracted the paper yet? And I'm like, can you respond? So this whole exchange happened. It started a day before I was supposed to go on vacation.
Ugh.
I'm supposed to be on this vacation. I'm can't resolve this thing. They're constantly not engaging. And then finally, I said, look, I'm not going to respond to email from now until I'm back from my vacation on Monday. And in terms of taking my name off, I'm happy to consider doing that if we have a discussion about the process by which this happened. Other people on my team had been writing to them saying this is a very chilling effect on their work, et cetera, that they didn't respond to. I said, if you don't want to do this, then I'll find a time that's appropriate for me to leave with, you know, with my manager, Sammy. But I won't respond to anything until I'm back from vacation on Monday. And so have a great week. That's how I signed off my email.
Did you in that email say, and if we can't come to an agreement, I'm going to choose to resign.
I didn't use the words I'm going to choose to resign. I said, if you can't agree to my number one, number two, which is communication, basically, then, you know, I'll find an appropriate last date that least destabilizes my team. And I'll work with Sammy to do that.
I see. And so they interpret this email, which you say is you seeking a resolution to an unresolved problem. They interpret it as, all right, she's out.
Yeah, they've been waiting for that time, I'm sure. Yeah, they've been looking for a reason, you know?
You feel that that's true?
Oh, I think not just me. A lot of people feel that that's true. So then the next email I got was from Megan Trolia being like, well, we accept your resignation as a result of us not being able to meet these conditions. However, we think your resignation date should be sooner than you said, because your email to this list or whatever was not becoming of a manager kind of thing. And my direct reports were so offended because they were like, this is the best manager I've ever had.
So how did you respond to this fact of what you feel was being fired?
Well, at this point, I did not communicate with any of them at Google anymore. Now I knew it's like if anybody communicates with them, it has to be through my lawyers, not me. But I will let everybody know that I'm fired from Google. They had no idea that it would create that kind of wave that it did. They just thought I would either be ashamed and shut up or I would speak up and nobody would care. They didn't think that they would be inundated with press requests or anything immediately.
This departure of yours, what they say is she resigned, what you say is, no, I was fired. It resulted in a huge political uproar.
Tumit Gebru was a leader of Google's ethical AI team who says she was fired after speaking out about how some AI systems are reinforcing social inequality.
I mean, it's remarkable. It's one of the most high-profile exits in Silicon Valley in recent years, right? There were more than 2,600 Googlers, who signed a petition on your behalf. There were more than 4,000 academics and engineers and industry colleagues who signed a petition basically calling out what happened to you as an act of retaliation by Google.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The Washington Post, the headline for your firing was, Google hired Tumit Gebru to be an outspoken critic of unethical AI. Then she was fired for it.
I didn't expect it. I mean, I expected some amount of support, but I didn't expect it to be like that huge of a thing. What I did know was, for me, I was constantly public about what happened because I wanted to make sure I told my story the way it happened before Google came up with a story, right?
That's a strategy right there. You wanted to have the first mover advantage.
Yeah. I mean, I knew. I just knew I had to tell my story. And I was talking to the press. I wasn't afraid. I wasn't like, oh, I'm going to be quiet now, whatever. Because I have nothing to be. I'm telling the truth, right? When you're telling the truth, you don't have to be afraid of defaming or whatever. I'm like, I'm just telling the truth of what happened and I can back it up.
After you got your truth out first, Jeff Dean, the head of Google AI, sent an email in the company.
Mm-hmm.
And what he said was that Tumit's paper, her scholarly work, it didn't meet our bar for publication.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, maybe it's just not good enough.
I mean, you know what the dog whistle is, right? Like, you know, I mean, you're below the bar. Like, how many people have heard that when they talk about, oh, you know, we need to have more women, or we need to have more Black people. Well, yeah, but we don't want to lower the bar, right? Like, that's basically what he was saying about my work. So that dog whistle, a lot of white supremacists heard it. After that, I started getting a lot of coordinated attacks. And so that created another wave of just hardship, because then I started having these stalkers. Then I started, you know, it was a whole thing.
A number of scholars disagreed with Google's AI chief. The paper he characterized as subpar was published in an academic journal. What did this backlash teach you about how power works?
That we're in a system where the powerful get away with it. I mean, they get away with it. You know, Megan Cotrulia is still at Google making money. Jeff Dean is still at Google, you know, making money. He has power, all these people. I think collective advocacy helps. We have a lot more power when we're collectively advocating for each other. But currently, we're at a time where it still is not balancing the power that these people, these multinational corporations have. That's really how I feel.
We reached out to Google to respond to the events that Timnit recounts. A spokesperson replied in an email, quote, "Our goal is to ensure that every employee experiences Google as an inclusive workplace, and we've been focused on building sustainable equity for Google's Black community," end quote. The spokesperson added that they've been hiring more Black employees and investing in retaining them. I used to be a tech correspondent for NPR covering Silicon Valley, and I've spoken with many people inside the tech community. And as you and I talk, I just keep wondering, like, how do you think tech bros would hear this conversation?
Oh, my God. Well, let's see. First one is this work is too political. So it's advancing a political view. And so you should separate science from politics. Science is not political. It's apolitical. It's meritocracy, objective, blah, blah, blah. Secondly, you can't just, you know, tell us about the problems without proposing solutions. Some of us, okay, we build things. We don't criticize. We make things happen. Whereas you are just out there yelling about problems and you know, complaining all the time.
Mm-hmm. They're builders and you're a complainer.
Yeah.
As you and I both know, there's a really strong anti-government streak in Silicon Valley and in tech.
Yep.
Like, you know, I think about, for example, Mark Zuckerberg talking about it.
It's just that breaking up these companies, whether it's Facebook or Google or Amazon, is not actually going to solve the issues.
Kai-Fu Lee, a very powerful Taiwanese investor.
I think one needs to be careful about how to regulate these companies. You know, simply breaking them apart isn't going to solve the problem.
Sergey Brin.
I think the regulatory burden in the U.S. is so high that it's, I think it would dissuade a lot of entrepreneurs.
Elon Musk.
The government is simply the biggest corporation with a monopoly on violence.
These power men have given the message of don't try to break us up and don't try to tie our hands.
Yeah, because they're going to save the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I just can't stand it. I mean, they made it super clear that they're very comfortable squashing peer-reviewed scientific work just because they don't like it. So how can they then turn around and talk about self-regulation? It's kind of funny, you know?
Dr. Timnit Gebru did not throw in the towel. She's got a lot of fight left in her. In the months after her departure from Google, she spoke with foundations and investors, including some in Silicon Valley, who want to help her. So she has started her own company, a nonprofit called Distributed AI Research Institute, DARE. You announced it on the one-year anniversary of your breakup with Google.
Yeah. Yeah.
The timing's pretty good. It was classy. Yeah. So you launch with funding from a handful of foundations. A total of $3.7 million. Nice way to start. Though I have to point out, as of this morning when I looked, the market cap for Alphabet, Google's parent company, is $1.73 trillion. Given that power disparity, explain, how will you make a dent?
I think that the way to make change is you do one small thing and it might have a ripple effect, right? Somebody else might replicate it and somebody else replicates it. And so then you have a collection of DARE type things that counteract some of these large tech corporations. So that's how I hope to make a difference.
And so the hope for theory of change is, hey, me, Dr. Timnit Gebru over here in my little slice of the world, I'm going to light a little fire with whatever we can do.
Mm-hmm.
And then hopefully that helps light a bunch of other fires.
Yeah. Instead of trying to like control the world or whatever, you do something, you show it works, and then other people replicate it in a way that works for their context.
So you have a lot of faith in other people.
Well, I have to. I mean, otherwise it's too depressing, you know, right? You have to have faith in people to a certain extent and their ability to change things. Otherwise, I mean, it would be too depressing to think about some of the things that are happening in the world without thinking that you can change it.
My lessons from Dr. Timneet Gebru. 1, first mover advantage. If you have a falling out with someone, it may be in your best interest to get out front and frame the situation. Instead of cowering in silence and fear, you can shape how others understand what's happening. 2, make new friends. If you realize you can't trust your old friends, look for people you can trust. It's not easy, but they're out there. 3, use your platform. We spend years and years getting to the highest echelons, telling ourselves we can make change once we're there. Then we don't cash in on our privilege. When you have arrived, know it, use it. This episode of Art of Power was produced by Hina Srivastava, Justin Bull, and me, Arthi Shahani. It was mixed by Joe Dassault. Our intern is Sylvia Goodman. Our executive producer is Kevin Dawson. If you like what you heard, give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts or share it. Nothing like word of mouth. Tell me what you think. On Instagram and Twitter, I'm at Arthi411, A-A-R-T-I 411. For exclusive offers, you can sign up for the Art of Power newsletter at wbez.org/AOP newsletter. See you next week.